Welcome back. This is Rhetorician Wednesdays. That's what we're branding this as now. More rhetoric on your Wednesday than you've probably ever had in your entire life. But I thought it's a good way to sort of make primary the fact that rhetoricians and the whole tradition of rhetoric have a different take, or maybe a more coherent take sometimes, on what's going on in the world. And so Wednesdays are just going to be pure rhetoric. It's what we're going to get. This is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. I'm Dr. Dan French, American rhetorician, humorist in training. You're always training in humor. And this week we have, again, for the second his second episode, Dr. David Payne from Emeritus from University of South Florida.
Thank you, Dan.
You're back. Good to see
you. Again.
Yeah, and I was telling you at the start, like, I liked the turtleneck, like, glasses, gray. It's a gray professor look, so I clipped it out for your placard.
Very good.
I did
it's
like
it. Soon be much too hot in Florida to keep this up.
Well, and people don't, you know, I got to figure out some sort of attendant way to do our notes and things like that that go along with the podcast. Like, you can put them on YouTube, but it's fairly limited. But people should also see your other headshot that you sent me, which was with outside in the Florida background, you know, no lighting, like hat pulled down of make Orwell fiction again. Is that what it was?
Right. Had to have it.
Where'd you get that hat?
E.T. Etsy, how we pronounce it. If you Google them, there was two or three different sources, but somebody was selling them. I'd made them. So anyway, I bought a few and distributed them. I thought it's not a good hat, but it is a good slogan.
It is a good slogan. Be nice if we could actually do that.
The thing is, you know, we talked last time a little bit about, you know, people not wanting the confrontation, and I really don't want to wear the hat to the grocery store. What I don't, you know, whereas the MAGA people seem to have no trouble at all.
Well, I think
strolling into the voting line with their MAGA hat and.
I think that's one of the things that the liberals are missing. Like, if you're going to beat MAGA, I think you've got to get a lot more comfortable and sophisticated at confrontation. And I was thinking about this at the gym, because there's always the guys, you know, going around with the mask, you know, on their chin. I'm like, it's not a chin strap, dude. but going up and saying to them is going to be a difficult confrontation. What you need is an air horn that, you know, just screams out, put on your fucking mask. And so you can just walk by and go, and just keep on going. So we need to add more weaponry to our confrontation.
Right. You were talking about we need better insults. And one of my relatives of the other persuasion sent a clip of a sign that said, no shirt, no mask, no brains, or something like that. Anyway. Mm-hmm. And saw this as a blow against the Biden bipartisan that somehow this kind, you know, and when we heard it in the news in the last 24 hours with call saying this is Neanderthal thinking is a lot like the basket of deplorables, right? There's there's not an equal footing here on insult culture, right?
So no, not at all. And
maybe you know, somebody at the Don Rickles Institute really needs to get after.
Well, Biden always has that. He uses the word malarkey and folks and, you know, all that kind of stuff, which is fine in that it's hard to attack it. It's not as, you know, arcane and weird and awkward as basket of deplorables. But yeah, the Neanderthals is like, what's he got against Neanderthals?
Right. That is the counter move, isn't it?
I just think, you know, the right is into confrontation. They are artists of confrontation. You know, they'll go 300 trucks and a bunch of flags, and they'll have boats and everything else. And you can't just sit back and go, oh, stop that. You know, you've got to get better at more, you know, more interesting types of confrontation.
Well, I see this as an analog or a development for like how many years the Christian right has claimed this sort of minority victim status. We're picked upon, we're marginalized, even though numerically they're in a majority, right?
Right.
And it seems to me that the right these days is a counter movement in the sense of we're the marginalized ones, even though they believe themselves to be in a majority. But they've already taken the impious stance here that of assaulting institutions and traditions. So whereas when I was in college, it was quite the left was the rebellious, impious assault the institutions, right?
Yeah, so
there's been this kind of co-optation of
they trade weapons back and forth. Like it's crazy how the shell of the rhetoric is there, you know, the technique, and they can put any armaments into it. They can put any content into it. It doesn't matter, you know, just as long as they're firing off the shells and they can have that experience of, oh, I'm attacking, you know, or I'm defending, you know, like the victimage thing is crazy. It's really just a masquerade for stupidity, right? Like the stupid are oppressed. You know,
well,
and victimized.
That is one of the binaries working through here, sort of the smug superior liberal versus right.
Yeah, but it goes both ways. Like they're smug about how stupid liberals are.
Punning libtards is the, you know, the prime mover in many of these things, I think, right? Once again, it's kind of almost an insult culture.
Yeah, it's clearly, you know, when you get into the praise and blame stuff and the epideictic approach to this, that staining, the ability to stain, no matter what the stain is, it makes no difference. Just the ability to imprint some kind of mark on your opponent just becomes like the dominant force, you know. And again, you talk about Trump, what a great, he just had a big black magic marker and just like would just write on everybody and it just stuck.
Sure, and once again, if you are dealing with division, both the rhetoric of both camps addresses is the solidarity and unity of their own groups, and so it's one of the hallmarks of groupthink, for instance, that you vilify the opposition, right, and have mind guards that you know that protect the group from the information from the other side. So this is all self-addressed, I mean, as a way of maintaining esprit de corps and to reduce whatever the other side is to a stereotype and vilify them, right? So this is sort of playing itself out. That's just another symptomology of division in the extreme that we have it.
I think I've seen this a lot in the liberal left and the educated left and intellectuals in general. They tend to label something a negative technique, and then they just will try to shy away from it and stay away from it. And as if they never do that themselves, instead of owning it and saying, yes, you know, part of rhetoric is the dark arts of rhetoric about staining the other side and being pious about your side, right? Those are very effective techniques. So we should use them consciously. And you can try to be ethical, you know, and we'll get into ethics. And, you know, I know that that term has sort of, you know, risen up for you. But like there are, to me, like giving that away to the opposition, like the opposition is not going to stop doing that. They own it. And they've gotten very, very good at staining your side. If you're not as good, if you don't get in there and learn how to defend and how to, you know, counterattack and all that, you're going to lose, you know, on that rhetorical. In that rhetorical coliseum, you're losing.
Right. I think, once again, that both sides haven't decided they're playing the same game. The left says, okay, well, we're right, and being right should be enough if you'll just leave us alone, right? But they want to transcend the conflict. We talked a little bit about that the other day. They don't really want to engage the conflict.
Right.
Whereas, so they're not seeking the transformation, and but the rhetoric of the right at this point in time is transformative. If you just look at the brief clip I managed to not avoid of Ted Cruz at the CPAC last week, right? Very much the rallying the troops, right? We're the rebels here. And you know, once again, the politics of that are are going to be different. Here's the mainstream and the rebellious assault. So once again, this gets back to, you know, a term you use, piety, right? Who's being pious and who's being impious? And I don't know if equilibrium is going to get you very far, right? It seems like, well, gee, we need to do this on the other side. And in many ways we are, right? In many ways, that's already going on. As you pointed out, we're using the strategies, but maybe not in a mainstream. We want to preserve the space of national politics as bipartisan, representing everybody with a certain manner of speech. And that's exactly what they're being impious about.
Right.
I mean, shrieking about taking on the Capitol building, right? I'm shocked and dismayed too, but it seems to me to be more than an insurrection. It is that kind of ultimate impiety. You don't believe we would do this?
Do you think so? I see this a lot from, you know, the left, you know, I guess, and I think piety is a really good way of approaching it, because the how dare you, you know, penetrate the inner sanctum of democracy, you know, of Congress? How could you possibly come into the temple with that kind of, you know, impropriety and all that? So it really is a pious moment.
That,
and they've got to hold
the
that
sacred space, right?
Yeah, and they've got to really heighten that in order to, you know, come out good in that rhetorical situation. Like if they take away, because what they tried to do, I remember like one of the insurrectionist thing was, this is our house. Like they were lowering the piety of it, or at least moving the piety over to, you know, people control, as opposed to this kind of national, you know, democratic, you know, piety. And so it became like, well, we belong here. And everybody else was like, no, like this is the church, you know, and you can't go in there.
Well, I mean, if you just look at what they did once there, right? I mean, there seemed more than a plan for taking over the government. It seemed to me that I'll put my feet up on Pelosi's desk. I'll steal the podium. I'll, you know, use the bathroom.
I thought all those pictures, and they were ready to be celebrated for those pictures, for how impious they were being.
Right. I mean, there must have been various components there. There must have been a very serious group of people that, you know, wielding weapons and some with bombs and that must have had at least fantasies they were going to do something more serious, right? But what we have are the imageries that are played over and over and over and over and still, right?
Well, they didn't have the weaponry. They didn't really have the weaponry to turn it into a military zone. They had a few things like, you know, they keep showing the zip tie guy and things like that. But if they had had guns, you know, and if there had been any opposition for real, then it would have turned into a military story. I mean, the left has to drag it over into a military story and a death story and, you know, that kind of stuff in order, again, to raise up the piety of what they've done, the impiety of what they've done. And, you know, it's fascinating, like there is no, when there's no anchor to what those things actually mean, like what is pious for America? Like it's completely open right now. They've cut all the roots for our normal pieties, and there's no way to, like you said, like Ted Cruz, they're basically just jumping over and grabbing other pieties. You know, they're like, well, we're trying to protect democracy by making sure the elections are run well. It's like, that's totally not true. Makes no difference. It's just, can they own that piety long enough to get some juice out of it?
Well, and clearly their belief that was justified because, right, the election had been stolen. If you buy that premise, right, and that seemed to be the one that sent them marching into the Capitol, that this was to keep that, the right, this was to preserve democracy. You know, and once again, we can argue with facts, but what you're really arguing with is this web of pieties, right? Burke could call piety a sense of what goes with what, a set of linkages. And we're trying to fight this elaborate set of linkages between what their movement is, what it is about, what their symbolism is, their role in all of this. What is this movement about with logic? But it's not about logic.
It's story.
And so,
right?
So once again, when you know, I think ethics is something to talk about, but they see their actions as ethical.
Right. I mean, ethical is just a horrible, slippery, useless concept. I just like to start.
Well, there isn't some standard out. And once again, it's complicated for rhetoric because there isn't one sort of standard. Clearly, we know people shouldn't lie. Yet there is this sort of gray zone where we're all embellishing. We're all right.
Yeah. And, you know, I write about this a little bit in some of the classes that I'm doing, like the whole concept of language, you know, it's the Nietzsche essay on truth and falsity in an ultra-moralistic sense. All language is a lie. You know, it's an illusion of a sign pointing at something over here, and we just accept it and all act like it works. And so there's so much slippage in the basis of language. It's, you start moving over into levels of lying. The problem, like, I think what happens now in this kind of, again, sort of simulacrum culture or non-logic based culture, or maybe it's just hyper competitive culture, where you get, instead of having a fairly limited set of pieties that are all kind of agreed on, like in Christianity or something like that, all of a sudden you get multiple religions and multiple pieties fighting each other. And then you cut the roots, and so they're all floating up here, so there is no factual or logical basis to it. And at that point, like, it's just like, which balloon is prettiest, you know? And then just see them grab like a balloon. It's like, oh, the QAnon balloon, that's interesting. And what do you do at that point when logic becomes this sort of skewed, you know, like skewed logic is just as strong as regular logic right now. And impiety, or, you know, sort of unmoored piety, is just as strong as moored piety. How do you come back into that as a rhetorician and start assigning some strengths and weights and doing some actual persuasion or conversion?
Well, I think dealing with it, with what it is, and maybe there isn't one set of strategies. Maybe those have to be adaptable because they're so easily co-opted by the other side, right?
Yeah,
I mean, maddening. The charge of cancel culture against a group of people who've been trying to control culture for 30 years. I mean, that's, you know, it's a good slogan, but clearly we have a struggle here, right?
Right.
What are both sides contributing? But I think the thing about pieties and ethics is that at least that terminology, as Burke spun that out, was that these people are building an ethical universe here, which is a set of symbolic linkages between, you know, how they make a living and how they support their families and where they are historically and geographically. Driving a brand new pickup truck down the street with a Trump tag waving out the back, what is, right? These are expressions of some kind of identity.
It is piety, right? I mean, and
it
within
is.
That sense of religiosity and fervor and, you know, zealotry to it, that, like, the truck, start with the truck. You know, I talk about this all the time in Texas, you know, for a homophobic state, they sure do like to ride your ass. You know, and there's always some truck up behind my stupid little Prius, you know, just hovering. It's the piety of them that the right has for that kind of truck culture, you know, what it says and how it harkens back to the horse and to the history and all that stuff. Like, there were no Priuses. There were not even what I saw sedans in those, you know, those lines of trucks. Like, you had to have a truck, and sure, then you had to have Trump. Like, they've installed Trump, you know, in that piety figure, all the way to the point of putting him in Jesus clothes and, you know, the golden idol last week at CPAC.
Right. Right. Well, and what an unlikely candidate as Bush, you know, he learned to talk Bubba and swagger Texan and.
Yeah, goofball.
Right, had a ranch as a great prop. I mean, one could almost cover the seams there, but Trump doesn't even like dogs. How can he be the hero how can this man be the Jesus figure? And so I guess the remarkable thing
how do they pull that rhetorical magic? Like to install that guy who's so unqualified as a character into their Jesus slot. Like, how did they do that?
Well, I'm speculating here, but maybe the deal is that the structure is there waiting to be filled by something. Right. And the structure is more important than what fills it, right?
Yeah, for sure.
I guess you started off saying that. You can fill it with whatever content you want to. I mean, it is remarkable that they can overcome these kinds of contradictions and disconnects. But nonetheless, they do. And that means that there is something more powerful underneath that wanting to be occupied. But I think the thing you just kind of hit on is I see this ideology as kind of a lint ball picking up these different symbols and right there is no kind of coherence working
right.
out.
There's no it. Center to it. Yeah.
I mean, if you just heard in the last day and a half about the March 4th today, the re-inauguration of Trump that is allegedly taking place. Even though, like most QAnon predictions, it really doesn't happen. And
that doesn't seem to be a problem.
Where does it go? But kind of the it's sort of like numerology. There's a sort of, that he would be the 19th president because after our 18th president, the corporation, there's this sort of elaborate scaffolding inside of these things, but it draws from, and I guess we noted that in talking about conspiracies too, it seems to be able to combine almost any set of disparate elements into.
That's one of the things I find interesting about it from like a narrative perspective, where narrative meets logic, you know, where they can take that skew logic and they can weave it into a story. And when they can do that, it's a lot stronger for people than just pure logic, like just doing argument and laying out, you know, claims and evidence and stuff. People can't do that, but they can weave it together enough in a narrative that skewed logic, you know, gets that sort of double life from the story itself. And then it's just little pieces of things that they don't really have to do any kind of logical analysis of, but it makes for a nice, you know, sort of energized universe of a story.
Right. And so people manifest a certain kind of rhetorical experience. And I think what's intriguing here is we don't know what that rhetorical experiences are that bring them to this particular cocktail. I mean, our description just now of their sort of confabulation of all these disparate elements, standard American ideology that we all grew up with in school, for sure, is the same thing. It just took 200 years, right? I mean, you know, we in school, we drew pictures, outlines of Abraham Lincoln and George Washington. We heard the story of the cherry tree and the flag salute itself, which we assume must have been there from the beginning, was really only, you know, created in the early 1900s. Things that are the sacred, right, elements there were sort of confabulated across a long period of time. But that was public and kind of overt. So even our standard sort of set of, you know, semiotic of icons there is of the same stuff. Or you look, I don't know if you remember that old article about the Super Bowl parade, whatever, the number of different kinds of symbolic strands that come together there from military and business and, you know, why that particular set of symbols are being, or any parade really. But so I guess the thing about the Trump cocktail here is it's shocking each time we learn of these linkages to another pocket of meaning that is being exploited there. And I think ultimately you have to sort of ask, it's not, the meaning is not in those things as much as it is in people's willingness to go there, their own activism, seeking expression and focus.
I think that what you just said with this idea of exploiting these pockets of preset meaning, and they have grown up over a long period of time in the society, and the society has constantly dumped rhetorical energy and resource into those. So like the flag or the different songs around the flag, you know, all these different things that we did grow up with. And it's almost like, you know, politicians now have discovered they can go in and break open each one of those pinatas, whether they deserve it or not makes no difference. Just break it open, pull out its innards, and just use it. And then when it loses a little bit of energy, just move to the next one. You know, it's the thing like we were talking a little bit about, like cancel culture. Every time a new one comes up, like Dr. Seuss, there's six books that are clearly pretty hard to read in context of, you know, his world and the way he thought about Asians. And so they want to take those out of the curriculum or out of availability. And then Mr. Potato Head, suddenly, you know, degender the potato people, like just make them potatoes. Like, well, it's not as fun if it's just a potato, you know, it's like, what's next? You know, what about people without noses? You know, like how can you have a nose on that thing? You know, it's totally against the noseless. But anytime something like comes up that's been charged in the culture with rhetorical possibility, it becomes a little site of harvesting and exploitation, a little bit of a site of conflict, and then they move on to the next one.
Right. Well, and when one, I mean, these are kind of ways of keeping the conflict visible and alive, right? That each, you just can't let it pass, right? Dr. Seuss, even though I'm not sure Dr. Seuss was such a great, you know, the anti-nuclear activist, and the Cat in the Hat's a great disruptor too. Impious. I'm not sure he was such a right-wing icon until now. But and I didn't know Mr. Potato Head really occupied any significant space. But so it is.
Anything that's culturally charged and pop culture, you know, that's the other thing is like our pop culture is so strong in people's experience now that they have been charged, like they've been revved up around it. They don't know it, but they have experience with it and associations with it. So it makes it politically useful to just go in and break open that pinata again.
Well, I guess two things. One is that you talked about sort of the interreplaceability and disposability of these things. They are constant. And so that's another feature of media. It's coughed up every day. And as it's been said, observed many times, Trump is really only concerned about the 24-hour news cycle and knows you can't disappear from that.
Yeah. It's what pinatas he can break open that day. That's all the guy did.
And it will disappear, you know. I mean, and you know, we observe Ted Cruz mutating from one moment to the next, and you know, all of a sudden he's the guy handing out stuff at food lines. And you know, they can count on that kind of forgetting. So it is sort of the omnipresence of those things that the continuous feed of that. But also, I wonder if. You know, there has to be a front line. And back to Orwell, that was kind of what the media function that, you know, he saw in 1948, mm-hmm. The 2 minutes hate. I mean, it just the omnipresence of it every day was kind of the secret of it. And I think for Orwell, and I guess that's the second thing, it's a distraction, right? Maybe all of that going on, which is really not that serious. Nobody's life is resting on whether Dr. Seuss gets those particular six books is read or Mr. Potato Head is gendered or not, is a distraction from other things where other more serious work is getting done.
When you're talking about that, just again, I have to control my comedy mind to decide how much to let out. Like, I think you should come up, like, again, my whole thing is, I think when you see the other side using a set of techniques, like, you are remiss rhetorically if you don't somehow go, okay, we have to meet those techniques or use those or, you know, or take them, you know, amplify them. So you should just do a, you know, completely sexualized Mr. Potato Head, just like, you know, big penis. He's just swinging around when he's walking and like, okay, we know.
I think that opportunity exists. I think that opportunity exists.
Yeah, give him a steak.
And you see some parodic stuff. I mean, the old Colbert show was certainly on that all of the time. And you see some videos where people put together these kinds of rants, like conflagrations of all these different issues. And and clearly, you know, make it parity. So, you know, in a way, we're cooperating here in keeping that kind of thing alive, it seems to me.
In a way, but I here's my problem with comedy in general when it does that stuff, and even the Colbert and, like, you know, so many the young people get their news from daily shows and things like that, is it doesn't go far enough. Like, it's nibbling, it's gnats. It's not really doing rhetorical work the way that the right is doing rhetorical work of taking that stuff and then doing, you know, fundraising with it and doing rallies with it and, you know, sort of doing real political rhetorical work on communities, whereas we're just turning it into comedy and then just forgetting about it. But, like, well, if right. you really wanted to go after that, like, that's my whole point about comedy. We don't push comedy for what it can actually do. I could eviscerate Ted Cruz, you know, for that stuff. And I write comedy about it, but you can also take it up a level to where you can do some maybe actual damage, political damage to that guy that will stick if you really use the creative principles within comedy well. Because it makes things stick if it's done right.
Well, do you have examples that come to mind of where comedy has done that?
I don't think, like, when you look at you know, some of our cartoonists, our political cartoonists, sometimes they capture stuff so sure. well, you know, that in just one picture, and you're like, yes. And you could see why in the past, like, maybe that was strong enough to do some political work. Because people, everybody looked at the newspaper and that was it. But, like, there sure. are memes that come out now that just nail these guys to the wall. And, you know, they come so fast and they're not, I don't think the right really uses them. Like, I remember Biden during the election, there was one other tiny scandal. What was it? Somebody on the right did something and I can't remember what it was. Maybe it was The Fly or something. I think it was The Fly on Pence's head. And just for a little bit, Biden made like one little tiny joke about it or something. And I'm like, man, I would have driven that fly into that guy's head so that people would never forget it. And I did for a while. Like, I wrote about, like, he looks like an undead vampire. You know, he looks like he comes alive every 1,000 years with that white hair and that ashen face. No wonder the fly was going after him. And if you take that, you take this super creative image, this nice little opportunity, and you don't let it die, like, you amplify it so you make it stick, then you've got some actual rhetorical potential in it.
I think so. And we will never know that, you know, the fly on Pence's head may actually have been a significant enough stigma to you know, along with all the other things. But, you know, we began, once again, back to Reagan, observing how he was Teflon, right? That these things right. just seemed to bounce off. And I think the thing that's staggering is how many blows Trump can take in terms of, you know, humiliation and that you would think would bring down anybody.
I still think the problem is that the left doesn't know how to make humiliation stick. And journalists don't know how to make it stick. Like, they just let him constantly dictate the menu, constantly dictate the agenda. And when he got something bad, he would just move on to something else. And they let it go. Like, you need to amplify it. You have to have a set of rhetorical techniques that don't let it die, you know, in the stream of new news.
Sure, sure. Well, I think, once again, the audiences that you're feeding may be different. You hit on it a minute ago that If comedy can be a framework of acceptance where it makes it okay because we can laugh about it and dismiss it. It defangs it in many ways. And if you're not inclined to engage the battle, then if all you want to do is feel superior or, right, and laugh it off and then return to normal business, it isn't fanged in the way that that you're talking about. If you're using it over here, on the other side, meanwhile, your state legislatures are gerrymandering the heck out of, right, or passing laws that restrict voting practices.
Right.
And nobody's minding that store, then it's working against you, right?
Yeah. And I, you know, that to me, again, is why I always like the idea, at least, of rhetoricians actually being used to help some of the strategy and planning for politicians, you know, for these political groups. because they don't really understand something like what we're just talking about, which is, hey, you were just given a massive rhetorical opportunity. A fly landed on this guy's head during a national debate for 2 minutes on white hair. And like for a day, it just flames up and everybody's memeing it. And they're like, yeah, I said, you know, and to just treat that like, and it doesn't have to be comedy. It can be anything. It can be tragedy. It can be chaos. It can be villainy. But like when that happens, you know, you've got to, you know, somehow burn it into the sky where the culture of, you know, come and go and the culture of streaming messages constantly changing can't forget it. Because you've lost, if you let that asset go, you've lost some rhetorical potential there. And I don't think the left understands that.
How do you address the sort of the bifurcation of media sources? I mean, it seems to me the fly and other embarrassments were, I think you're right, it kept up for a while and then went away. But how do you get the people attending to this other media source almost exclusively that isn't going to repeat that message or that image?
Well, I think that's the whole concept of, and you mentioned this in your notes from last week, of converting. That's why I chose the verb conversion, because just persuasion or light invitation or luring, you know, or here's a little bit of bait isn't enough to drag them out of that media universe. Right. Like, and if they exist in that media universe, you're going to lose. Like, there's no way to pierce that amount of messaging that well produced coming in that, you know, amounts 24/7. You can't out talk that, you know. You right. can if, again, like you start going, okay, well, they're used to talking in produced media, so we need to get something over into their produced media that will be, you know, kind of like a little media bomb. And you saw this a little bit with Buttigieg, like during the election, he started appearing on Fox News. They let him on and he got some of the left messaging in there, and he's very deft with it and came across as unchallenging and expert, you know, like he's not lording the fact that he speaks eight languages onto the Fox News people. But he existed over a little bit in that universe for a while. And I think you have to do stuff like that. You have to say, okay, well, this is the universe they're playing in. We need to build things that can compete over there.
I think over time that might be possible, right? That
the right did it. I mean, Bill O'Reilly and all those guys, they were super talented opinion people, and they could compete with the left, you know, the normal media. I don't call it liberal media, but it's that normal space media. They could get in there and do very well, and they earned
it. Well, they can gain audiences, as you pointed out, for entertainment value, right? I think a lot of it started that way, that not by true believers that were looking for truth, but
now they're just great
people who are willing to shop these other points of view.
And I mean, if you listen to Rush Limbaugh, you have to give up the fact he had a great voice. The guy told a great story. He could attack like nobody else. There was energy in it. And so it had all the entertainment, you know, foundations that would let it function in a real entertainment world. And so we have to do the same thing. Like if you're going to go out and grab people from that world, then you have to go and do it for real. You can't just say, oh, it's bad over there, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, but there has to be some kind of opening in their media diet. Because so much of, you know, whether persuasion or conversion sticks or not is sociological. It is who your support groups are, how you're getting your rewards that reinforce this over time. Is that working for you? So I think there is, you know, once again, you have to imagine that there's a range of people. And I really very much imagine this about, say, QAnon, that there's really, you know, it's a pretty, at least as far as I understand it, it's kind of a smorgasbord of this stuff, but it doesn't have really one sort of central compelling. It doesn't have any control over, you know, these people's lives. It's just sort of an input. And so there's these kinds of cafeteria shoppers that for entertainment value as much as anything else, Now, how does that become for some people this kind of source of truth and possibility and hope? And the true believers over here on one side. But there is this middle range of people who are only doing this for a while, and whether that sticks or not depends on what else they run into and how well those ideas work for them. So, you know, there's probably about half and half in any group. Otherwise, these things wouldn't mutate. I mean, if you think about how did the Tea Partiers become the Trump movement?
Right.
In a mere 10 years, which is almost completely contradictory in terms of the principles of governance embodied there with almost equal fervor and desperation.
Because it's not ultimately, ultimately it's not policy, it's fervor, right? And it's power. It's a way to gain power for people who have never had it. I mean, the Tea Party people, if you ever went to one of their things, and I saw a few of them, it was nerds. It was a lot of people that, you know, sort of did wonky policy in weird ways. It was a lot of constitutionalists, you know, the foundational constitutionalists and stuff like that. And those people have never had power. They've never had power in government. They don't have power in their lives, I bet. They don't have power in organizations and institutions. And it's a way of grabbing, you know, power with fervor and skewed logic. And they can do skewed logic. Like, if you hold people to the actual foundations and rules of real logic, how many people can actually do that? You know, almost none. Like, if you get into syllogisms and enthymemes and proofs and all that stuff, you'll blow your head up for most people. But they can do skewed, this kind of faux kind of light logic.
Right. But at base, it's where they're located in this ideological universe. What's this doing for them, right? And I do think morphologically, the Trump movement starts with the Tea Party, the post-crash of 2008, the conflict, the basic conflict about the bailouts, I think is kind of this grain of sand that people believing that somehow the Obama, the repairs, the qualitative easing, all of that was sort of the beginning of the end, and that things were desperate. And that was the Tea Party rhetoric. And I think, once again, it picks up and mutates as it goes along because it picks up different layers of discontented people. But I do think that's kind of the nugget there that started rolling, is that there is this contrarian point of view to everything that's taking place.
Right.
As a solution to this ultimate problem. And in many ways, this makes, you know, 2008 very much like the Great Depression in terms of what happens next, right? And in a way, we really, according to these people and the way they perceive it, really are still in this kind of second Great Depression. And economically, that is probably more true than any of us want to admit for many people. So, you know, what your description here reminded me of what Eric Hoffer, you know, styled as the true believers, right? The newly poor, the people who are, right, downwardly mobile, who've been knocked down, whether that's in terms of dollars in the bank or just their aspirations.
Right.
The healing, not part of the regeneration of the economy, left out. And that is kind of the essential warrant of, I think, a core ideology there that Trump picked up on. And so we may want to, you know, kind of trivialize it with this QAnon, you know, fringe kinds of stuff. But I think, once again, that's just kind of a shield for this darker workings that are going on behind that in terms of these disenfranchised people. But, you know, as Hoffer said, the true believer seeks to locate control of their life outside of themselves, right? This is the thing about it. And this is a difference between that group and the normally socialized people who've got their jobs, people who, right, are mainstream, wanting things to continue peacefully.
Right.
Right. They have a different level of investment here. This group of people over here, the true believers, see the control over their circumstances as living somewhere outside of them. And you hit it right. They're looking for control, and they're looking for relevance. They're looking for participation, right, to Hoffer's phrase, to dissolve their spoiled, meaningless selves in this spectacular undertaking. And that's when you hear phrases like, this is the greatest American movement.
Yeah.
You know, are the belief that this is going to happen? Where do you get the belief that, you know, the military on Inauguration Day was going to come in and arrest all the Democrats?
Right. Anyway. Well, and I think, you know, that's why when I started to look at this stuff, I got sucked into this through Trump. You know, I never paid close attention to politics. You know me, I like entertainment, I like film, you know, that kind of stuff is my sort of my natural interest. But Trump took over the world, took over all the media, you couldn't get away from him. So I'm like, I ended up I had to write jokes about him all the time for TV. And then I'm like, okay. And then my brain just started, you know, digging into this a little bit, like, okay, well, maybe I should spend some time to actually apply some rhetorical principles to this to see if I can help a little bit. And the first thing is, like, in the Converting Conservatives course that I have, it starts with exactly what you're talking about, which is you can't talk about this massive 74 million group that just voted for Trump as a thing. You have right. to look at it as it's a pie. It has 50 different slices. And, you know, the rhetoric has to be adjusted around each one of those. And sometimes they, you know, a third of the pie all shares a lot, but that kind of disenfranchised, like the rural voter voting for Trump, even though he is a New York snide, you know, the worst thing that they have ever seen, you know, for the most part in their lives. But they vote for him, you know, with great, you know, fervor and love. And you're like, how is that possible? Well, it's very different, that rule versus what you're talking about, like they've been disenfranchised in a different way than like just financial disenfranchisement, you know, or immigrant, like the immigrants that vote for Trump, you know, because again, disenfranchisement or not being able to enfranchise to the level that they want. But understanding that pie, even though it's, you know, disenfranchisement is probably one of the main ingredients in the entire pie. To me, rhetorically, that's what I think rhetoricians can offer, is like, okay, let's take this concept of disenfranchisement, and Trump is harvesting those people. Well, hey, lefties, you know, you're harvesting the minority disenfranchised and the youth and things like that, that you've always done, but you need to be able to go over there and harvest some of those, you know, middle-aged white people who are feeling disenfranchised, or you're in trouble.
Right.
So, you know, that's absolutely the game you're playing.
And party politics, you know, the party wants to claim on both sides that winning is validation, when more and more people are not voting for parties, right? The actual hardcore of each party is reducing over time. There are fewer hardcore Republicans or hardcore Democrats than ever before. But both want to claim that validation. But if you look at, you know, people want to talk about, well, gee, how many people voted for Biden? And it was a clear victory. But to me, the stark truth, there's 10 million more people voted for Trump in 2020 than in 2016, even though he was the least popular president and his approval rating hovered, you know, between 37 and 42%.
Right.
How can that be? Well, no, they're not voting for Trump. They're not really, you know, so, you know, what set of pieties are linking them to that rhetoric? And you'd have to do a similar kind of breakdown on the other side of the coin. Not all of the people who voted Democrat are buying the entire program there, and we're masking a lot of divisions obviously over there too. So yeah, absolutely, there's a lot of layers there in that voting behavior. There's a lot of, what is the range of persuadability there,
right?
And why, so that group of people, whatever set of, you know, pieties, whatever the rhetoric is that you're spinning out over here on the Democrat side, there's a certain group of people that are simply not choosing that for whatever reason, that's the persuasion zone, seems to me.
Yeah, for sure. And this is the pragmatist in me, I think, the working classness in me of like, hey, build it. I don't want to just talk about it.
Right.
You know, that I always come back to of, I thoroughly believe in rhetorical theory and good rhetorical criticism and insight into things. And like that, the idea that there are pieties on both sides. They're being, you know, sort of transgressed, and then they're being, you know, sort of put forth as, you know, sort of ascendancies. We need to know what those pieties are and those kind of alternative pieties that are fighting, so that when people are going into design rhetoric, like, I want to go after the rural voters in, you know, Nebraska, I want to know what their pieties are, you know, that they're voting for Trump, so I can design rhetoric specifically to address that. And to me, that's that kind of almost Cambridge Analytica level of target research that allows you to create effective rhetoric to work with those people. Because that's essentially what the right has done with, you know, piss them off about this and show them, you know, immigrants coming in. And that's a very powerful piece of rhetoric for that group. And the right or the left needs the same thing. You know, they need that sophistication if they're going to work with those people, because those are not simple psychologies. To say that somebody's rural and disenfranchised does not make that's a simple target. It's an incredibly right. complicated target.
There are Democrats in every red state, and there are Republicans in California and New York, right? That kind of over-determination of these categories is one of the chief barriers. Just intuitively on the way we're talking about this, and with your agenda, it seems to me that it makes more sense to try to track the impieties of each side. In other words, what are they being impious about? And that's when Mr. Potato Head and Dr. Seuss and, you know, I recall your insight that Donald Trump is in many ways a stand-up comedian. That's what he's doing in his rallies. That's what's refreshing. Even though, and not everybody right. is there because he's Jesus or the hero. I think those people are probably very few and probably unreachable anyway, because they're, you know, there's some kind of psychosis operating there that you're not going to reach. What are the people that are finding that bolstering that continual barrage? I was talking with somebody, and I guess Trump had been to Iraq, flown to Baghdad, I think was the case, and,
once,
and the
yeah.
electric grid wasn't working night. There. He made the comment, we spent $2 trillion and the electric grid still doesn't work. And this person said, see why I voted for Trump? Who else would say that? And I thought, you know, that's not really that remarkable of an insight. As a snide 14-year-old, I might have thought that was a pretty digging kind of thing to say. But for some person, that vocalized an unexpressed, you know, cynicism. And it seems to me that that's kind of what his mugging for the cameras is all about.
Yeah, no, for and sure. I think the right has recognized that America and a huge swath of America would rather see a roast battle than a political inauguration. I mean, Biden's inauguration was very, you know, traditional and very pretty. And, you know, they had a lot of good speeches and elevated language and things like that. And I think Americans have moved past that politically. It was fun to watch it from the left because it was so, you know, there was so much catharsis of seeing, you know, a grown-up again in that space and people who seem to be fairly, you know, decent people in that space. And you can compare that to Trump's, you know, burn down the earth, carnage, chaos inauguration. And they're doing a roast battle. And people like roast battles. They're fast and they're energized and there's a lot of emotion in them versus this kind of elevated political talk. So the question in some ways is, can traditional politics, no matter how well you do it, and there was some really good speech giving in Biden's inauguration, very well written, very inspirational. Can it compete in this type of entertainment environment?
Or can you do both at once? Can you still be bolstering, you know, the need for that sense of that language of continuity, that language of unity, that language of, you know, that connects us back to this tradition of, you know, patriotic tradition or whatever. can you do that and fill these other needs at the same time? Or is it always going to be, you know, one side gets to occupy one and the other gets to occupy the other?
I'm clearly, because I like working entertainment, and I know that if you do entertainment right, it blows the other thing away. Although, you know, politics is its own form of entertainment. It's just a drama. It's just a, you know, a high melodrama, and done well, it's pretty and it has all that kind of stuff to it. But I know like they brought in Garth Brooks for a few minutes to sing, you know, Amazing Grace. And my favorite part of that was after he finished, he didn't put his mask back on and he went and hugged the Bidens and everybody else. I'm like, he's just trying to infect everybody. You know, this is a plant. What a great plan. But he was so out of context with everything else, like just his jeans and his cowboy hat. And I would rather see the left be a lot more sophisticated and like, hey, you know, like we brought in a young poet and that was fun to watch. But that's not going to talk again to the 74 million, you know, disenfranchised over here. They're just going to see that as a feat, kind of, you know, small ball kind of poetry work. They want, you know, they want something that they can, you know, recognize from their entertainment training. And I think you can do both. I think like that's the only way to truly win. You don't want to abandon, you know, the traditions of, like you said, like good speech making, but come on.
Well, it seems to me that the traditional way that we went at this is that you had kind of the formal, right? We realized these were performances and that this kept alive this decorum, this manner of speech and all of that. But then there would be kind of like these Mardi Gras moments of inversion, right? Like the White House press corps dinner. But notice how all of a sudden that started going awry to where even with Trump, it wasn't even possible to do that.
Yeah.
You can't do parody. And I think Stephen Colbert's roast of Bush was even along that line. It wasn't funny because of the intense parodic quality of what Colbert was doing. Worked very good remote in space and time, but it wasn't quite the, whereas Laura Bush that night was funny as hell. Right. Just sort of showing the backstage, you know, the Bush. But there's somehow that traditional way of maintaining and regulating through these comic performances and parodies has gone way askew. Right.
Right.
I don't know. Well, we'll see what becomes of it. But it's kind of hard to imagine, even after the Trump hiatus, sort of returning to making fun of Biden in that same healthy spirit, because somehow the authority, the unquestioned authority, isn't there. Sort of the general consent that, yeah, we have that face, we have that image, and now we can make fun of it without danger.
Right. Well, I think everybody, right, is afraid that they might actually do a little damage to Biden and therefore make, you know, open the door again to the next Trump.
Sure.
You know, and I think one thing that I will hold, you know, on to, like, I think the right is winning, you know, a lot of times through infrastructure, like you're talking about gerrymandering and, you know, fundraising and that kind of stuff. But like what they're not really winning, what I can see coming up behind Trump, there is no other entertainer behind Trump right now. Like there's nobody else that they can rescue from the entertainment world that had done what Trump had done. He had run for president or tried to run for president ever since like 98, I think. And he was clearly into politics. He was clearly into the news and promotion and all that kind of stuff. There's nobody else. Like Hawley and Cruz and all these guys are not entertainers. They're not fun to watch. Trump knew that. And I used to watch this sometimes when Trump would be himself, when he would get out of the character, and he would be confused about why people would be so upset that he had just created a conflict. Because to him, it was, I think, the same reality show world of, hey, we're all just world, you know, this is just wrestling. Why are you upset? Like, I didn't really mean that.
This is just an act.
Yeah. And like, it really confused him that moving over into a world where you're doing wrestling on people's real lives, real policy, real money, you know, all that kind of stuff was a different game. But I don't see anybody else coming up behind that's doing what Trump.
Well, does it have to be, or is that, would it kind of be better if it were, right? In other words, is it scary that the next person won't be?
I don't know. I wonder if they'll be as effective if they can. I don't think they've got the entertainment energy that Trump came in and merged with political energy to create this pieties that you're talking about. Like he was a very, you know, he was a character. And so you could take him and drop him. Like when they made a golden image of him,
it was funny.
Right? It's like, that's just weird and funny.
And to let it go on, right? It is a strange insider kind of, yeah. Well, I mean, that's encouraging, I guess. But I do think Trump's election was kind of a political fluke, and it was not meant to happen. And I don't think he even thought it would happen. But it sort of grew from there, and God knows what happens next, because there are these other people clamoring for that sort of audience. But you're right about, I mean, I call it the Kong effect. In the 1978 King Kong, you know, Jeff Bridges is the anthropologist and Charles Grodin is the money grubbing corporate oil man or whatever. And he's saying, because Jeff Bridges is trying to defend leaving King Kong on the island, he says, well, you ask the natives whether they like King Kong. And the anthropologist says, oh yeah, yeah, they hate him, but you come back in a year and their whole society will have crumbled because hating Kong is the center that's holding them together. And I've always wondered if there isn't a kind of a Kong effect with Trump, that there's some sort of disintegration that will happen as a result of these performances have created a sort of a category that we'll want to fill somehow.
It's an interesting question. I just saw all the, again, catharsis and elation when the election, the day after the election, everybody was dancing in the streets, you know, and for like 24 hours, the whole world was like, you know, they could breathe. And then Trump, you know, started the big lie of, I didn't lose the election, I'm not leaving and all that. And then it just all clamped down again. And I think if people can hold on to that elation, like even, you know, Bush and Cheney and these guys, at least were still traditional enough inside the establishment that you knew they weren't going to blow up the whole establishment foundations in the country. With Trump, right, you never knew, you know, I think you said this at one point, there's no top end to Florida weather. Like, that's why it scares everybody. It's like, yeah, you know, as a little hurricane, whatever. No. They can just keep going up. And Trump had that. Like, there was no top end to what Trump would do. And that's why, you know, to me, like, it made perfect sense for what Trump was doing, that you do it until it fails, do it until it fails, do it until it fails. And then you finally get to fascism and actual violence. To me, the only thing Trump left out of the whole repertoire was he didn't use professional mercenaries in the insurrection. The next time they do this, they'll just use Blackwater mercenaries and they'll professionalize the violence, because these guys, the rabble, was not ready to be violent enough. They did not go Pence. They did not get Pelosi and take over. And so that's the only thing he left out of the arsenal from what I can tell.
Well, that you give me a hope and then you frighten me. Hope that somehow this will all right itself, and this is just sort of a phase, and that's possible, because there's a lot of money to be made in keeping things the way they are.
Yeah, and I think America
seems to always win ultimately.
This is our first taste of the ugliness of fascism, so hopefully it's bitter enough that people are like, hey, dude, like this country.
And things have been weird before. You know, people say we've never been this divided. Oh, I think in 1963 we were this divided. They killed the president, and it was a slightly different skew, but there was a lot of hatred and animosity going on. And, you know, if one really digs, and of course the Civil War, and maybe even times after that, in the resurrection of some of those issues that,
feel like this is almost kind of like a simulation of division? Like, I'm not even sure we're that divided. It's just the simulation again of almost a Civil War or a 60s.
Well, that's one interesting line of thought. I'm getting some kind of strange message here.
Like, I get, when I talk to conservatives, I don't have that hard a time talking to them. Like, it's not, I can blow it up if I want, you know, I can trigger, sure, but I can also find a lot of common ground. And you know, ways to ease the.
But I do think we need to focus. What are those resources for cooperation, and how do we access them? I don't think we can just write it off because there is too much political money to be made here in keeping this going. I mean, the Hawleys and the Cruises are seeing they're not anxious to do away with this kind of energy. Seems to me.
They have nothing else. They have no other. This is the only thing they can win with.
And your statement that on the day after the election, we all breathed easier. Well, not really all of us. I mean, I think there was a group of people, and we don't really know because we're too busy lumping people into these two groups. We don't really know what the extent of that is, but clearly there was a huge number of people that my world doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
There were so many Trumpians who believed they were going to win that election that the belief that they did in fact win it was, you know, overly tempting. And I guess the numbers are pretty staggering that 73% of the people who voted for him still think he won, despite all of the conversation since then. So, you know, exactly, and we never even quantify exactly how many people that might be, right?
Right.
But at any rate, it's like the Tea Party turning into Trumpism. This is going to turn into something else. And it's probably not everybody's just, there's not going to be a moment where everybody just declares, oh, we're over it and we're all going to trust the standard normal narrative here.
No, it's exactly,
yeah,
it's created its own mythological streams and now there's energy in it. So people again are going to be politically harvesting from it forever. You know, it's clear like the culture wars have spun out all sorts of little islands of power, of rhetorical power. You know, now this has spun out all sorts of, Trump is, you know, just a major, he's the big island, you know, in Hawaii, in the Hawaiian chain, and he has the best volcanoes. And it's like, yeah, it'll be around for a little bit longer. I think, you know, there are things about him that are, you know, going to end up sinking him far more than people realize in the next few years. But there'll be other islands that pop up like this, you know, people that are able to harvest that energy and, you know, from these sort of cultural, little cultural volcanoes. But yeah, I'm not, put it this way, I'm not optimistic about what is going to happen with the politics, partially because I don't think the left really understands how to use all this stuff. They're still trying to hold on to their old systems. And I see this all the time in business when I do marketing for companies. They're still thinking they're living in an old, like old America, like old world. I'm like, have you looked around at the way people are using media right now? Like, you can't, if you're going to advertise to people, to these kids, my kids run through TikTok and YouTube and everything like at such a speed and with such a sophistication that if you're not figuring out how to get your messages to succeed in that world, you're just wasting your money, you know, and politics is the same thing. And I think rhetoricians, if we can merge that big, you know, sort of knowledge base like this, like which is in David Payne's head, you know, like you've gone in and rescued Pieties from Burke and you explain it very well in the context of what's going on now. That's a very useful concept. If they could actualize it into, you know, actual rhetoric that they put into the world.
Right. Well, I do think you touch on the central things is that the fragmentation of media is a fact that is going to continue and people are going to change in relationship to it. Other cultures have lived with more fractious politics, you know, for a long time.
Yeah.
I do remember back in your day, I directed an MA thesis from somebody from Lebanon and, there's like 140 political parties and graffiti was the primary way of signing what you do, right? That's a very different kind of political world and way of being political than what we are. And so, you know, the confrontation of this two-party system and the standard ways of doing things, but, you know, change seldom happens in sort of an organic, forward-looking, oh yeah, adjustment kind of way. Usually things fail and then get repaired.
Right. That's interesting.
I am encouraged. The Democrats do seem to be getting better at media spectacle.
I think you can't help but sort of feel your way towards different things and you start bringing in newer, younger people and they will, you know, force that stuff. The difference to me is always like, you know, get some really good, clear awareness from your rhetoricians. You know, they can advise you so that you, you can speed way forward. You can jump ahead of what the right is doing. You know, like we talked about this earlier, and I thought about it, that we were talking about how do you get into the right's media universe, you know, and do any work. Well, what the left really should do is just create their own Fox. You know, they should out propaganda the propagandists.
Well, I guess some people would think MSNBC is that, but
yeah, but it's not. It's like they're maybe doing sort of leftist or more liberal type propaganda, but you have to do right wing propaganda. Like the way Colbert did, you know, he went in and created a comic character that inhabited their character, but subtly undercut that character all the time. And so just create another Fox, you know, call it Big Fox, and just program it with the same kind of conspiracy shit, but go beyond QAnon conspiracies. Get some real writers to create a better set of conspiracies than QAnon, and they'll come, they'll flock over there. They can't tell the difference.
Well, as a rhetorician, I have a question for you in terms of your work and your obvious sensitivity and thought about comedy, that we talk a lot about this moment in terms of these kinds of comedic and impieties and the evolution of comedy in the media and its infiltration into politics and whatnot, that we can do battle with it, right? It's still a viable weapon on both sides here, seemingly. Will that continue, or is that right? Is that something we can always count on?
You know, anytime you start trying to extract real value from comedy, you're walking dangerous.
You're already in trouble, huh?
Because comedy, you know, as a universe, like, it has no moral function. And I've had this argument with people for 40 years now, ever since I started doing stand-up, that it does not have any requirement to be nice to the oppressed or the wounded or the harmed or anything. If you put any of that into that universe, you crimp that universe. And we don't want that. You may not want to go in there and hear what the writers are really saying, you know, but that's the best comedy. That's the most pure, you know, form of the isotope, that if you could hear it, you'd be like, oh my God, that's funny. And most of the time we don't even get access to that, because it does break the piety of the serious, you know. And I sort of have lived across these worlds for a long time, like going over into stand-up, which is just a universe of impiety. It's a universe of comedy, and it has pieties, but the pieties are different. Like there, the laugh is the piety. It doesn't matter what you say. Does it get the sort of gut bust laugh that people can't not give? Like, no matter how ugly the content is, the art of the comedy is so good that it wins. And in writers' rooms in Hollywood, that's what it always is. What's the ugliest thing can you say in the most artful way? How far can you take it with the most art? And whoever does that in the room wins that day. So it's just one of those things that you can't, you know, go over there and start trying to extract moral value. Now, it can do moral stuff, but it then warps the comedy world. So I'm very careful about saying, okay, we're doing moral comedy right now, great. You know, we're doing political comedy now, great. Some social use comedy, great. But that's not real comedy. Real comedy is over here just doing whatever it wants.
So it's not inherently one moral or another. Well, I think there's something humanizing about going for the laugh. I think there is, so there is in a kind of a transcendence. It does, in a way, sort of say it's okay. And I get concerned when I see people losing their sense of humor, back to the kind of the cancel culture, political correctness and the tragic stance on both sides of our current political division. So I think maybe it does draw us into some place of commonality. So I don't know if that's a moral
it's
a function or just sort of the stage on which one might take place.
But it's the perfect Burkean conclusion, right? Of the comic frame is forgiving, sure. And ergo, it's the one that everybody should use. And comedy does have that. It's like, we're not talking, because I made a joke, I did not make your life worse in a real way. Everybody's like, oh, you're normalizing, you know, being mean. And I'm like, no, you're not. You know, if you are listening to a comedian telling a joke and then you're going out and punching, you know, some oppressed group in the face, you're going to punch them in the face regardless. Comedy did not bring you to that point. So saddling it with that, I think like comic frame is just joy. Where's the fun? Where's the laugh at? You know, and we can't stay in that space clearly right now with this many people in the room. You know, wounded people don't accept comedy about their wound. They just can't. If you're going to do that kind of comedy, it has to be constructed in a certain way where it does have healingness and it has commonality and that kind of stuff. And you can do it, but then you're, you know, merging comedy with a new, with a second world and forcing comedy to do something it doesn't really want to do.
Okay.
Doesn't really want to heal anybody. So, well, it's been super fun, man. Once again.
Good to see you. Thanks for knocking.
Yeah. I like I said, I'm going to keep coming back to the rhetorical well. You always make me think. Good stuff.
Very good. Well, thank you. Good to see you.
Absolutely. And this has been Rhetoric Warriors Podcast with Rhetorician Wednesdays. We will be back and see you again soon.